Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's audio conference training on strengthening staff skills, engaging with men, women, and children in supervised visitation centers, offered by the Office on Violence Against Women in partnership with Praxis International. My name is Beth McNamara, and I'm the program manager with Praxis's Supervised Visitation Technical Assistance Program. So welcome to those of you who are new to our audio conference training series, and welcome back to those of you who join us on a regular basis or whenever you can on these types of calls. It's very nice to be with all of you again. To give full disclosure, we wanted to let you know that we are recording today's call, and the audio recording will be available via online streaming at the completion of the entire series. And we'll pop that up on our website. And so you can go to the website at praxisinternational.org and download that anytime you want. It'll just stay there, so there's no need to rush. But it sometimes comes in handy if you aren't able to stay for the entire call or you're missing one part of the series or if you have staff who couldn't come. So that will be available to you. Just another little disclosure about that is that we won't be able to post it unless the quality is really good, because otherwise it's completely useless, but that would be the only reason that it wouldn't be posted. All right, thanks so much for understanding that. Materials for today's session were emailed with the registration confirmation that I sent out, and then I've also posted them on our website, so you can go to our website and download those now if you have access to a computer. But otherwise, we'll try and, if you weren't able to download them or you don't have them in front of you, it's not necessary. We'll try to keep you up to date of where we're at in our plan and our outline and move from there. So we also want you to be aware that while OVW supports the notion that grantees have access to technical assistance and support and training from a whole variety of sources, this training is being presented by Praxis International. And while we're supported by OVW as a technical assistance provider under this grant program, the points of view presented on this call are those of the speakers and or Praxis and not necessarily representing OVW's viewpoint. So while we try very hard to stay in line with OVW as well as all the other TA providers, we are not speaking on behalf of them. We would like to thank OVW for supporting all of these opportunities for us to explore new ideas and think out loud with each other. I think this is just an amazing opportunity for all of us to take a short amount of time out of our day, out of our week, out of our month, and sit and think about something that you weren't thinking about 10 minutes ago. So we appreciate that. Today is the first session of a three-part series. Today's topic is de-escalation and conflict management. And this is a topic that I think every visitation center has been faced with at some point. So when I was putting this series together in my mind, you know, I'm thinking, what are kind of the top three things that I think we could mull around a little bit more and enhance skills and doing this better? And this bubbled up to the very top. Like, how can we think through this in a little bit better way? Not have it kind of drive us, but we have the ability to shape and form how we can do better with this. So that's how we came to this three-part series and how we came up with this first part. So in my thinking around it, I do think that this does cause a lot of anxiety. It comes with a whole bunch of complications. It comes with a whole bunch of fears. It comes with a whole bunch of assumptions. And so what I'd like to do a little framing for all of us is that we'd like to emphasize the importance of the visitation guiding principles that guide our work and use those as how we can base and move through our thinking on what we're doing in our programs as a whole and with this issue. And then in addition to those, I want to highlight kind of three important tenets that I think should ground our thinking on the topic of de-escalation and conflict management. And then we can move through the rest of those trainings and the training and what that means. But I think the first tenet that I'd like to explore with you is respectful and fair interaction that holds care and compassion in their highest regard. The second would be fostering safety for battered women and their children in everything that we do. And thirdly, that we'd like to counteract the experience of being battered and the tactics of battering. So that's how kind of we're framing up, and then we'll move forward. So today on our session, we have the honor and the privilege of having Tracy Parker with us on the call today. And so the two of us plan to move through this exploration with you. So I'll just give a minute for Tracy to say hello and introduce herself.
Hello. Tracy, I'm calling from Kent, Washington. Some of you may have been here, and I'm the project director here and the site supervisor. So.
And been doing this work for a number of years.
Yeah, my background is in advocacy before I came here, and then I've been the project director for this project since 2003, and then the center opened January 2005, and I've been the center director since that time. So, I also have a lot of experience in working, doing volunteer work in prisons and working with men on nonviolent conflict resolution, so that's, this is kind of a, I'm really glad we're doing this call.
Yeah, she's a very smart thinker on this, so I'm glad she's doing this call, too. So our grand plan, and then we'll get started. I'll turn it over to Tracy to get us started, but I wanted to let you know two more things. As you know, we try to mute. Oh, we don't try. We do mute everyone's line except Tracy and I because it can get loud and noisy. We have a whole bunch of people registered for this training series. So if we opened up all those lines, we would just be able to hear you all in your offices or wherever you're calling from, eating lunch or, you know, multitasking. Not that you wouldn't do that while you're listening intensely to every word of this training, I'm sure. But, you know, just stuff happens in our daily lives. So we try to make it conducive as much as possible to enhancing everybody's ability to hear clearly. But we want to also balance that with your ability to participate on this call. And so if you do have questions or you have something to add, please feel free to do that. We will take intentional breaks. So in about 35 minutes, we'll take our first intentional break for questions and answers. But if you have something to add, you can get in the question queue by pushing the number 1. Just push it once, because if you push it twice, then you delete yourself out of it. And Amy is our operator today. So if you push the number 1, Amy can put you in the question queue, which just means that your line is going to be ready for a question, and we don't have the delay in getting you in the question queue. The other option is you can email me at any time during the training, and I will try to just insert those comments and questions for you as they come into my email box. So my email is Beth, B-E-T-H, at praxisinternational.org. That again is Beth, B-E-T-H, at praxisinternational.org. So those are the last two kind of housekeeping details that we have. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Tracy. She's going to get us started on our training content, and then we'll move through our exploration together. Thanks, Tracy.
Sure. Okay. So I've been thinking about this for a few days. Beth approached me at this a while back, and I looked over this a survey that had gone out a while back in relation to another training around fear. And I thought it was really interesting, the things that people talked about or mentioned being afraid of. And so before I talk about those, I'll just say for me, what I started thinking about is when I'm starting to feel fear around anything happening here at the center, what's going on? And so, you know, the obvious answers that come up right away are, you know, I'm afraid somebody's going to get mad at me or something if I have a confrontation. And then if I go beyond that, what does that mean, somebody's going to get mad at me? And for me, what I really ended up sorting it down to was that I think my biggest fear is that I'm going to say something that makes everything worse, that I'm going to not think it through before I open my mouth and make things worse. And I don't mean just things here, but things in the whole big picture for the families. And so it was interesting, then I looked through this fear survey, and that seemed to come up for a few people, the notion of making the situation worse, giving him something that can, or I'm saying him, I'm sorry, but any member of the family or anybody involved, an attorney that calls, a GAL, whatever, that you're going to give some, that I'm going to give some information that might not be taken as professional, or it might be too personal, it might be too biased one way or the other, or too much focused on parenting instead of on safety. So I think for me, that's what comes up. And so that that is something I want to talk about as we go, and just kind of reminding ourselves of what is it that we're really afraid of. And I would encourage all of us to think about when we kind of think, oh, I don't want to do this thing, or what's going to happen if I intervene, trying to just spend some time with that with yourself while you're not in the thick of it, of course, but being able to think through what is it that I'm really afraid of. Is it this that I have to intervene? No, it's usually not that. It's that what's going to happen when you intervene. And then think it through, sort it out. Try to get to the core of what you're really afraid is going to happen in response to a conflict, and in response to a confrontation, in response to having to give somebody bad news. What do you think is going to happen that you might not be able to handle or might not be able to control? Because I think for the majority of us, it was reassuring to see on the fear survey that for most people, it's not really about being physically assaulted, though that's definitely there for some folks. And I'll say there's been times here where there's one or two instances where we have, one or the other of us has definitely felt threatened to some degree, but that's not the majority of the case, and usually there's other issues involved when that's happening. But I would guess that it's more of an emotional fear of just having no control over the situation or not knowing how you're going to control yourself. So I just wanted to put that out there as we get started and just really encourage people to kind of think through the core of the fear. What is it? And then that can get you started on what you need to work on and how you can address that, because if you can sort it through out in the open and debrief it and talk with people and get feedback, it kind of can really reduce that instant going to fear. So one of the things I wanted to talk about was, and also I want to say before I go on any further, if anybody has any thoughts about a fear that comes up that isn't being addressed here, please press number one in the queue and let us know. We want to make sure we're addressing the real situations for the folks that are listening. So please feel free to add anything at any time. So I want to talk about the types of conflict that tend to come up, at least here at Safe Havens in Kent, and what I hear when I do trainings around the country and have been to lots of the different conferences and doing this work with all of you for a long time. And for us, I think that you hear from frontline staff the fear of intervention, what's going to happen when you intervene, and then also the fear of when you have to give somebody bad news, that their visit's going to be canceled, that the other party's late, that a child is refusing. You might have to tell a custodial parent that, you know, you got a call from an attorney that things are changing, the order might be changing, just when you're going to have to tell somebody something really difficult. And then there's the kind of conflict that comes up over misunderstandings. And so where somebody has a different idea of what your role is than what you do, this can come up with visiting parents or custodial parents. Somebody, especially we have all dealt with exchanges, I think, and where one parent, the custodial parent, might think we have more control over what happens outside the center than we actually do, and you have to kind of say this is the limitation, we can't do anything once they're not here, and we can't report things that we didn't witness, and that sort of thing, and or misunderstanding with the visiting parent about, this is not about my parenting, you're telling me, you know, I've never hurt my kids, and, you know, trying to help them sort out what your role is around safety and just your policies and guidelines. And then the other fears, for us, and everybody does this part different, but when we actually end up releasing files to families, we don't send things to the court, but we do send things to the families when they request them, and they go to each side. So sometimes we know that's really going to cause a problem, and we know that, for us anyway, there's never any surprises in that file. We're pretty transparent with everything that we're documenting. But still, when one party knows the other party's going to see that, it does send up some red flags, and often they want to challenge us on that, which is, you know, for us, we've created some policies around that. Like, we don't ever hand people their files, we mail them so that they are reading them somewhere else and they have some time to cool off before they contact us to discuss it. So those are all different types of things that come up, different situations, different types of conflict. They're all different scenarios that are going to bring up different responses. So what I'm wanting to encourage us to do is to be thinking about how they're different, because I think sometimes we get really wrapped up in this and we kind of lump it all together that, oh, this guy's a pain in the ass and I got to deal with this again. And we forget that there's different levels of things that are going on. And so we don't want to overreact to something that doesn't really require a huge response. So really thinking about, is this urgent? Is this something I need to address right now? Of course, when we're in the middle of an intervention, we're making a decision that it needs to be addressed right now. And I think that's why it's really important to be clear on why you would intervene and have a lot of staff discussions around why we intervene, what's the purpose of the intervention, because if you're really grounded in that, you can then, you don't have to be in a confrontation about it. You can be very clear about what this intervention was for and how you're gonna handle it. If something blows up in the moment, you've got to really think about how, in advance, all of this stuff you've got to think about in advance. And we can talk more about that pretty soon. But being prepared for if things blow up, what's your plan? Like, is the goal to get the child out of the area if you're going to have a confrontation, or is the goal to just get the behavior to stop for a minute while you regroup, or you can talk about it after the visit? There's different ways to intervene. There's things that are urgent that you need to stop right this instant, and other things that you can hold off, discuss it with the visiting parent afterwards, and let them know that the next time you're going to have this different response. So I think really thinking through what requires immediate intervention and what can hold off. Again, if you have to give somebody some bad news, kind of think through this, what your relationship with this person has been in the past, how they responded to difficult news, how bad is the bad news. If we are going in to tell a visiting father that the child is refusing, that's a lot different than going in to tell them that they're 5 minutes late. And so we have to think about that. What's the difference in those situations, and where would it be okay for him to have a lot of emotion around that? And where you can just say, you know, well, they're going to get here as quick as they can, and we'll come and get you. We'll give you as much time as we can. We can soften things to quite some degree if we work at it. And then also remembering that sometimes we may have something come up in a visit that we know we have to intervene on, we know we have to discuss it with this person afterwards, but sometimes it's just too fresh, and maybe we need to wait until cooler heads prevail, until everybody's had a chance to think it through, and we do not have to buy into the urgency of addressing things right on the spot. And I think that's where my belief is we get ourselves into trouble a lot quicker when we think we have to respond right now. Because I think it's okay to stop and take a breath and say, you know, I'm not sure that I can address this right now. I need to think it through, or I need to talk to my peers about that. Or you can say, you know, I think you're too upset right now and I'd prefer to wait. And we can talk about it when all of us are calmer. It doesn't always work, but, I think when we kind of appeal to the higher self, people rise to it. So I just always want to try to give us the benefit of the doubt, give to our clients and to ourselves. And then the last thing is to think about on these types of conflict, these different types of conflict, when we're addressing them, what's our desired outcome? Are we looking at a short-term intervention, immediate safety that we have to address right now, or do we want to try to figure out the long-term relationship? Is this family going to be with us for a while? I know for us, when we have had to use the police, which fortunately has been very few occasions, that relationship is now sullied forever, and we've not ever had that occur where we could really ever resume the relationship in the way that it was before. So it's for us a pretty serious thing if we feel the need to call for law enforcement. Now, that's not to say that we haven't had them on call before. We sometimes have had officers here in the staff area in case something came up when we knew that there was a really serious issue about to happen. And we felt like maybe they should just be here to help us. We don't have on-site security. But we have made it very clear to those officers to stay out of sight, that we don't need them unless we ask for them. So we just have them here for an emergency. And that's also been very rare. So I think really recognizing when you do certain things, there is an impact. And always put safety first, by all means. But recognize if it's not urgent, maybe we don't need to treat it as urgent. And just remembering that these are families, and that even though there's been a lot of battering or some of them are pretty horrific what's gone on, we're generally not their target. We're generally the ones they want to impress. So I think keeping it in perspective is really important. And with that said, if anybody has any questions, they can go ahead and press the cue, and I'll pass it on to Beth.
Okay, so just remember you can push 1 and Amy will help you get in the question queue, or feel free to email me as well and we'll get those comments and questions in. So the next piece that we're going to talk about is a verbal escalation continuum. And so typically what this means is that there's typically a progression that people move through in the way in which this escalates for people. So you may not see every step of this on the continuum. They may skip steps, so there's no magic to point. You'll see everything in front of you from step 1 to step 2. But I think the helpful piece of this is if you start paying attention to the very little things, the very earliest stages of this escalation continuum, there's a lot of ways that you can respond before something is to the place where you didn't want it to end up, and all of our fears of the things that we have just talked about, of what can happen, what we think will happen, all of those places. So by paying attention to kind of the very little things, hopefully you'll be able to kind of respond in a way that moves you through in a different outcome. The very first thing we're going to talk about in the continuum is questioning. And the first thing I want to say about questioning is that not all questions are bad. So not coming from a perspective of if somebody is questioning you, that's coming from a place that it's going to progress or they're doing it on purpose to challenge you. They can be seeking real information, and so it's important to seek out or sort out what's being presented to you and whether they're just seeking real information or whether those questions are posed to you as a challenge, that they're not true questions, they're avoidance, they're trying to get you off track, all of those kinds of things. Those are the two distinctions. So ways to respond to questioning, first is if it's, valid, just information-seeking questions, to respond calmly and give them the answer that they're asking. The other appropriate response is to stay on topic. And so whether it's a challenge question or whether it's a real question, it's important to stay very calm, stay on topic, redirect, restate kind of the initial request or response that came from you. The next stage that we're then going to talk about is in the continuum is refusal. And that's kind of the slight loss of rationalization. And again, the best response is to try and stay calm, stay on topic. And you may want to then start setting some limits, some clear limits, which means that you are concise about what you're requesting, the limit that you're putting on, and that whatever you're indicating is enforceable. The other thing to start paying attention to is nonverbal cues. And so what we know about how people communicate is that nearly all of our communication happens nonverbally for the most part. I heard a stat thrown at me once that 90% of all communication we deliver is nonverbal. So the things that you want to start paying attention to for people is their body language. So start looking at how they're presenting to you. So look for things like muscle tension, breathing, a change in breathing. So if they're holding their breath or they start breathing very fast, their posture, their facial expressions, look at their hands. Their hands are very telling most times. A lot of anxiety. You could look at clenched hands as being an indication, or wringing of hands. Things that weren't happening before. So if they're sitting down and they were tapping their foot or moving their foot, tapping their finger on the side of the arm of the chair, something like that, and then all of a sudden it stops. You want to pay attention to kind of that kind of behavior, or if they start that behavior that they weren't doing previously. So
those are licking their lips or smack, their mouth gets dry when people are asking.
Yes.
Just notice that.
Yep. The other piece to think about is how your body language is coming across to people. So not only do you want to pay attention to who's in front of you, but also what you are portraying. So how are you positioning yourself? Are you backpedaling? Are you tense? Those kinds of things. And then it's also important to hear how you're communicating. So a lot of times when people's anxiety is heightened, they probably are not listening clearly to your words, but they're listening to how you're saying what you're saying. So tone of voice, the volume, the rate of speech. And what I think of when I think of how I'm saying it, not what I'm saying, is when I talk to my dog, you know, I can tell him the craziest thing, like, "Oh, you are such a bad dog. I can't believe you just did that." And he wags his tail at me, and he's so happy that I'm talking to him, and he has no idea the words that I'm saying to him, but it's how I'm saying it. And so I don't intend to equate that we should talk to the people in front of us as our pets or our children, but it's kind of the point of how impactful the way in which we're presenting something makes. Not necessarily to say that what you're saying isn't important either, because that is a byproduct of the outcome, but it's very important to pay attention to. The other things that you want is to respond to when you're kind of in this position of that slight loss of rationalization, so they're in that refusal stage, is to listen, try to avoid the me versus you situation. Don't fake attention. This is picked up immediately, that if you are trying to formulate your response and you're not listening to what's happening in front of you, or you're trying to get the attention of somebody else in the room or something else, that can immediately escalate behavior. So don't fake. If you need to step away, then that might be a decision that you need to make. But if you are intending to try and give somebody the impression that you're giving them 100% of your attention and you're not, it creates a lot of problems. Being non-threatening. And the other thing that I think sometimes is very hard for us in visitation centers, especially because we carry a lot of jargon that we don't realize that we carry. But in this field, we've created a whole bunch of words that the rest of the population doesn't necessarily carry or use on a daily basis. And we tend to kind of throw that out a lot. And that really creates confusion. It creates frustration. And it comes across as you're talking over them or you're talking above them in a way that's not receptive. So pay attention to kind of the words that you're choosing. Then the next stage in our continuum is release. So this is the point where people are acting out. There's an emotional outburst. There's no focus. So an appropriate staff response, you could look at a couple of possible options. First is you could let them vent. You want to pay attention to who's around, so you may need to remove the audience. So if there's other families that are in that space, or other parents waiting in the waiting room, for example, or other services happening if you're in a lobby or something like that. So try to remove the audience, either remove the audience or ask somebody to move to another space. And then if you're making the choice to let them vent, then just wait for those quiet moments. So wait for a breath to be taken, one of those pauses that sometimes happens after a long venting process is to just, in a very non-threatening way, show compassion, show understanding and reason, and restate your directives. So being clear and concise again. The next possible stage of the continuum then moves on to intimidation. So that could be verbally or non-verbally threatening. And some possible staff responses is to remove yourself. Remove the audience, remove you, and tell them clearly that you are leaving. They may be at a point where they are or aren't listening to you, but you should clearly indicate that you are leaving and the reason that you're leaving. And if you're going to stay, if you've chosen to be in this moment with them, you want to increase the space between the two of you, or be aware of how you can increase the space between you if you need to. And know that they want to be taken seriously at this time, so that if they sense that they have to somehow save face or act as if they're going to do what they've threatened because they feel pinned or cornered into doing that, try to pay attention as much as possible and give them as many outs as possible so they don't have to feel like whatever they've talked themselves or said or pinned themselves into a corner that they need to then follow through. So allow escapes, allow venting, allow redirection, allow compassion in this moment. And then in these moments of intense intimidation in this continuum, the possibility of grabbing a weapon or using a weapon is there. Obviously, you want to increase space then. And respond appropriately, knowing what research tells us is that the longer a person does hold a weapon, the less likely they are to use it. So just know that that's a reality. Then the final stage of this continuum that we're going to talk about is tension reduction. And this is the point where they gain rationality. They're often at this point scared, embarrassed, fearful. They try to start regaining some self-esteem around what just happened. And so staff responses at this point would be to acknowledge the situation and talk about it. You want to process it. You want to process it with the audience, if there was an audience that you couldn't remove. All the other staff with the person. All of those pieces have to happen, whether that happens instantaneously or whether you take a break. Those are a lot of choices in this scenario, but this at this point in this continuum, you don't want to let that go, never being processed, never being talked through, and then putting some closure on the situation. So that's the continuum that I think is important just to be able to dissect. And again, knowing that you may not see all of this in front of you, people may jump, people may have come to you with a lot of other things happening before they come to you. So there may be things that you aren't able to pick up on or aren't being able to notice. But if you start paying attention to those little things, hopefully you can respond in a way that moves through that process with them. All right, we're going to take a little break for questions. I see from Amy that we do have a question in the question queue, so we'll take that. Amy, would you mind putting that through?
Not at all. And if anyone missed our first instructions, if you have a question, all you need to do is press the number one once. Our first question comes from the Nick Agneson Group. Your line is open.
Hi, my on the first part of this, on the fear, I guess my biggest fear is information that is shared with the families or others that are we covered by confidentiality, and should we have that in mind when we do share information? I'm aware of certain aspects that if that information might cause harm to a child or another third party, that we should keep that private. Any suggestions on that might alleviate my fear of inadvertently given out information.
Right. Okay, thanks for your question. And thanks for being our first question. You're very brave.
Very. It's a question we were afraid of.
Right. So my suggestion, I don't know what state you're calling from, and I am not an attorney, so that's my disclaimer. So it is important for you to check your local laws and your state laws about confidentiality. My understanding is that there is not a state yet that has legal protections in place for supervised visitation providers, which means that as a visitation provider, we have extremely limited ability to maintain any confidentiality. There has not been a challenge to visitation centers yet in being able to protect private information such as identifying information of address, phone number, place of employment, those kinds of protections. But other than that, there are no real ways that visitation centers can keep information super secret, right? You can't tell somebody that no matter what you tell me, I'll keep it in the strictest confidence, because you probably won't be able to do that. So I think the first important piece to do and to think through is how you're explaining your confidentiality policies, what your confidentiality policy is, and what your limitations around confidentiality are to both all the people who work in the center with you and then all of the participants who come to the center.
I also want to add to this that I think this is where your relationship with your court partner is critical. Because if you're working closely with your court partner and they have a clear understanding of why you're doing what you're doing, and they're going to be less likely to just sign a subpoena saying they want all that information. You can ask for in-camera reviews. For us, there's information that we do release with no problem to the families, and information that we would really resist and would require a subpoena, and we have not been subpoenaed for that information. I think what Beth said is true. You don't really hear people trying to get it. It's pretty blatant to say, I want to know where she lives and what she's doing, and you know then how you document that kind of a request and how you respond to it can be really actually helpful to show an ongoing pattern of somebody's persistence trying to find out where someone's at.
Can I still be heard?
Yes.
Oh, okay. That's pretty much how we're aware of our laws in our state. We're in California, and we try to apply them where they apply, and we haven't been challenged per se. But that gives me some direction on, I want to protect the child, the victim, also the perpetrator, too, to a certain extent. They have rights also. But I guess that would be, you pretty well answered my question, because I've done research and can't find any precedent that gives us anything, so we're using what our organization has in place, and we're learning, I guess. So
yeah.
Anyway, you've given me, reduced my fear of that. That would be my biggest fear.
Good.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. Amy, do we have any other questions?
At this time, there are no further questions in the queue.
Okay.
I did want to add something to something you were saying, Beth, around the whole piece on intimidation and decreasing the potential by increasing space. And I always want to encourage us, if somebody's really getting to the point where it feels like it's escalating and they're going to lose it, I think it's really, for us, it's been really helpful to say, you know, we really don't want you to say anything that you're going to regret. It's okay for you to go now. And then we've also had training, and I'll talk about this in a bit, but this guy that trains us always said, let them get out. If they want to leave, let them go. Hopefully you're not having this conference. I mean, you have to think all these things through, of course, but for us, we wouldn't usually have a serious discussion while the mom was still, the protected party was still there. We would wait till she had left, so if that was possible. But saying, you know, if this is getting out of control, we're going to need to call the police. You can leave or you can wait. And giving them the option of going. It's not trying to tell them they can't do this, that they need to stop, but really acknowledging that they're having that this is not help, this is not going anywhere right now, and you want them to not blow it too, right? I think they, even in the thick of things, sometimes people can get a grasp on, oh, I don't want to push this any further. And we'll do that if they're yelling at us on the phone. We'll put them on, we'll say, we're going to put you on speaker now so that there's three other people here hearing this, okay? It's time to end the call. And that tends to work. Sometimes it doesn't, and then you've got several people that heard them threaten you or whatever. You know, so you have something you can discuss with them later if that's what happens. But I do think really giving them the opportunity to end it at when you can is good.
Okay. So I think the other piece that we should explore a little bit is that there are underlying factors that can cause acting out behavior. And I think it's important to be able to dissect those a little bit to know where what's in front of you is coming from and to be able to pinpoint those so that your responses are appropriate to what's happening, or that you can do a little bit of deeper thinking or exploring about what is actually happening in front of you. So the first thing is that you want to look at is that there could be kind of this loss, either a loss of control, a loss of personal power, loss of a job, loss of a loved one, and that need to show that they're still in control in some way is overpowering sometimes for people. So that could be one of the reasons that what is happening in front of you is happening. Another thing to think about is that they could be trying to maintain some self-esteem. So they could have talked themselves into a place where they didn't want to end up. They don't know how to get out of it. And so it just continues and carries on and escalates to a place where they didn't want to go, but they didn't feel like they had another choice. They didn't have an out. They didn't know how to stop. And all of a sudden they find themselves in this place where now they have to kind of save face. Another thing to kind of consider is that people respond when they have fears. When they have fears of the unknown, when they have fears about our power as a visitation center. As a visitation center worker, the perception of our power that we have within the system, our connection to the system, there's a lot of assumptions about how we're connected to the systems that may or may not be true. And a lot of assumptions about what we can and can't make decisions about, who we influence, all of those kinds of pieces. And so that fear of our power is very real, and it's very scary for many people, particularly because you're talking about their kids and their lives and their futures. And so it comes with a whole bunch more than just as a place to come and see your kids or as a place to drop off your kids. It's much, much more than that for many people. And then fear, because they don't have a lot of information. So the system can be intimidating. It can be misunderstood. It can be confusing. And so at the time that people are coming to our centers, they're in the thick of it. You know, they've come through a huge system, a huge process. And most of the time, it happened so fast, and they don't really understand where they got to, how they got to there. They heard pieces and parts. They chose not to hear other parts, so they didn't understand, and so they come with a lot of missing pieces, a lot of missing information. Another underlying factor that you may be looking at is attention-seeking behavior. Also be looking at displaced anger, which means that you are the safe person. You're easy, you're available, I see you every week, I've seen you every week for the last 6 months, and I know you'll listen. I'll know you'll come to me with compassion after you listen, and so all of those things could be a reason that that happens in front of you. There could be some psychological issues, some physiological things that are happening, so it could be substance abuse, could be hunger, could be that I haven't slept in 3 days, could be some mental health issues that you're either aware of or not aware of. And then the final thing to kind of dissect as an underlying factor that could be causing all of this is some perceived or real injustices. So people respond to not feeling like they've been treated fairly, either by the center or by the system or by the police or the judge or the mediator or the their attorney. You know, I mean, the list could go on with examples that you hear every day. And so that could be kind of the driving force behind what's happening in front of you right now. So to be able to dissect that and process that a little bit so that you're able to either problem solve or respond in a way that connects with them, incredibly helpful. Because if you're off base with your response, they're not going to connect back with you about, you don't understand, this is has nothing to do with what you're talking about, you don't know my life, you know, all of those things. But if you can get closer to kind of the real reason, you have a better chance of connecting with them in a meaningful way and in a way that they can hear and respond to. All right, Tracy, I'm going to turn it back over to you. Just one more shout out. Well, it's not going to be the last one, but if there are questions, please let me know. Amy will let me know, and also to email me, and I can pop those questions or comments in too. All right, Tracy.
And I just think this underlying factors piece can't be emphasized enough. I feel like every single time we've had a blow up here, if we step back and look at the factors that were leading up to it, you can just see them so much clearer. Somebody's just about to get sentenced. They know that this might be their last visit. That is the loss of control. They're trying to figure out their finances over the next few months, or their house is in foreclosure. Somebody that's coming here and their children are refusing, and that the embarrassment of that, what that means to them, and you know, here they've been telling us how much their kids are going to love them and want to see them, and then the first thing that happens is the child says no. That really, a lot of people will react in ways that aren't really most beneficial to them, but it's the way that that's the way they know to react. And I just think that can't be emphasized enough. We really have to always consider what else might be going on. And I think this takes us back to how important the relationship is with the whole family, to be checking in. Is there a court case pending? Is something new happening? Did somebody move? Was he able to talk to you before and now he can't? You know, because you can start to then anticipate where there might be some tensions happening and work before there's a blow-up to try to smooth things out to the best of you can, or just offer some empathy, offer an ear, and just listen. I think that's so important. So I'm going to talk a little bit about power struggles now. One of the things that happens that I see here, and I know when I'm doing it, is if I'm trying to be right, or one of my staff is trying to be right, that doesn't help anything. And so I think it's really important. I know when I've got too much invested in something, I think I'm actually pretty good at that, not having, being attached to an outcome when we have a discussion. But I know that there's times, and some people are more difficult than others. You know, that some personalities work better for me than others, and somebody will trigger me, and I just want, there's a part of me that wants to just, like, slam them down, use my intellect, just win this argument. And that is not helpful. The minute I find myself wanting to be right, then I am trying to make that person wrong. And when you're trying to make somebody wrong, there's no win. It's just, it doesn't work. That's not relationship building. So I think really noticing when you are feeling yourself, if you're having even physical responses, or when your heart is racing because you're thinking about the next point that you're going to get them with, that's a power struggle. And one of the things we need to think about, if we're working with people who batter, they're used to having all the power, and so we don't need to play that game. We have a lot of power in the center. It's a given, and so we don't need to promote it. We don't need to flaunt it. We just need to be compassionate. The other thing is when we find ourselves lecturing versus problem solving, and this is one of my pet peeves, when somebody is trying to talk with one of the men about to something they did in a visit and wanting them to understand how hard that was for their children or how unfair this was, or that they're, that is just trying to put them into a guilty phase or to get them to agree or feel bad in some way. It goes with judgment and really, I just want you to understand that I'm doing this for your own good. It's when, who among us really listened to our parents when they were lecturing, or a teacher when they were lecturing? It's really when somebody's trying to problem solve with me, I respond a lot more effectively. If somebody comes to me and says, you know, I didn't understand why you were doing the thing you were just doing. Can you tell me about that? That's a lot more of an invitation than somebody saying, you know, I noticed this thing you did was really bad, and I want to tell you why. That just shuts the doors to communication. And that will lead to an escalation. If people don't feel that you're respecting that they have some say in what's going on, then they're going to respond in a way that's not the most productive. Also, knowing when it's time to just let someone else take over. I think, you know, it's okay to say every now and then, I know some of those centers are really limited on staff, but to say, you know, I just can't deal with this person one more time this week. It's been a bad few times. I don't want to be the one that they're mad at. And that can be with either parent. Sometimes we just get burned out on having to deal with the same issues over and over again. We all know that we always have a few clients that are just, they use up a lot of your energy. And I think it's okay to just decide, you know, for now I'm going to step out of this one if I can. If you can't, then even if you can just get one other staff member to just share the burden a little bit and just negotiate the best you can, or at least make sure you have a place to vent and talk about it so that you're not taking it out on the client. That it's really, we're the ones that are the professionals, and we really need to remember that these people, they're not coming to us in the best times of their life, and they have a lot of stuff going on. And so if we can not add to that, that's great. We already have a lot of rules and regulations that I think anybody would be resistant to. I probably wouldn't be a very good visiting parent, I think, sometimes. But, you know, so we want to be fair, and we want to be respectful as much as we can. So that's kind of what I'm thinking about power struggles. If anybody else has anything to say, please let us know again. And now I just want to talk a little bit about some ways to deal with it when it's happening. So, again, I said earlier, I think the main thing is to be prepared before it happens, to just do some role plays with staff, bring in trainers. I mean, we can all role play our families probably better than anybody, and why not practice at staff meetings around how to handle a certain thing that might come up if you think you're going to be intervening. I know often there's a time when we know an intervention is coming because we've given somebody an opportunity to change a behavior and it just keeps happening. And now we know we're going to have to kind of do it in the middle of the visit, and what's going to happen, just practice. What's the response going to be? Because sometimes I think we just let it rattle around in our heads and it gets bigger than what it really will be. And so if you just kind of play with it a little bit and find a way to be prepared. And for us, what's been really helpful is every couple of years we've had a trainer come in, and we've used the same guy. He's fabulous. He works at a soup kitchen down in Pierce County nearby, he's an MSW, and he's a minister. So, I mean, he's just this really great, well-rounded, older guy who comes in and works with us around how to deal with people who are being really belligerent, because that's kind of what he does all day. And he's really kind and loving and has great stories to tell. And he always tells us to remember that whenever somebody's in acting up, they have a need they're trying to get met. And he always gives me all these great little things I use everywhere. One is to just remember, to think about while you're listening to them, oh, this is an interesting way to get your needs met. Don't say that to them, but to be thinking in your mind that somebody's trying to get something accomplished, and what is it that they're trying to get accomplished? I think that can be really helpful. And then the other saying that he gave me that I just love is to look at them with awe and wonder. And I use that all the time when sometimes I'm really frustrated with how somebody is just constantly trying to get around us and pushing our buttons, and you just like kind of think, wow, that's pretty creative. they're able to continually do that and keep it up so well week after week after week, you know, despite our challenges, despite our trying to negotiate. Wow, they are, aren't they amazing? And I think that really helps to just keep it in perspective. I don't have to get personally engaged in changing anybody at their core. All I can do is try to help them do as well as they can here at the center. And hopefully that just is a good way to model just working relationships, and that we can be respectful and disagree and have boundaries and still not lash out. So the first thing I think when you're in the middle of something coming up is to remember to stay calm and to breathe. I think when you get afraid, it's your human response to kind of your heart stops a little bit, you catch your breath. You got to remember to breathe. Slow it down, take a deep breath. Stay calm and lower your voice if you have to, because people often, if their voice is getting louder, we find ourselves rising, our voice rises to their level. Don't do that. Keep your voice either calm or even soften it, because they will respond in kind sometimes. Not always, but sometimes just that. Like if you talk to a group of kindergartners, if you whisper and they're all running around and you start whispering, they're going to stop what they're doing and begin whispering or listening. So think about that. Again, back to body language with what Beth was saying. I really, when I'm working with somebody that's really upset, I try to stand in the most open or sit in the most open position. Like if I'm standing, my hands are down at my sides or behind my back. And I'm trying to just be as respectful as possible. I'm not standing like I'm ready to run. Though I do think it's important to think about your position in the room. If you can be near a door, that's great. You should never put yourself between his exit and the room. Give him the room to get out if he has to, and if you have a way to get out, that's great too. If you can have a second person there when it's getting really crazy, that's good too, as long as that person is just there in case to open a door to let you out or whatever. I just think you don't want to have a two-on-one in regards to the conversation, to the discussion. Excuse me. So the next thing is, the other thing is, notice what you're doing with your head and your mouth and your eyes. If you're looking away or if you're feeling flustered, I think don't try to stop that. Just let yourself be in the moment, but remember that this person is taking in what you're doing with your body. So if they're sitting, sit. Don't stand up over them. Don't look like a threat. If you feel like you are in danger, then by all means, give yourself space. You don't have to confront this in the moment. Next, acknowledge their emotions. I think that this is critical. And try to capture the positives as well. Like I had a guy that was really upset a while back, and he really escalated, and it was so clear in the moment he just had had it. He was getting ready to go off to prison. He felt like his whole world was crumbling and nobody cared, and the system was screwing him over, and he finally just kind of blew. It had been escalating for a while. So while he's yelling at me, I just stayed really calm, and I noticed my breath, and he would say, nobody thinks I love my child, and I just would listen for those things and say, you know, I know how much you love her, and it's clear she loves you too. And I know that this feels really unfair. And just like kind of parroting back where you can, not everything, and you don't want to be condescending, but to listen for the underlying issues, how somebody feels about something, and just acknowledge it. You don't have to agree. You don't have to tell them they're right or they're wrong. You just have to let them know that you heard it. And again, having compassion. And I think sometimes we have caught ourselves here that in the beginning when we first started, we were so worried that if we were too compassionate, we'd look like we were colluding. And you can be compassionate and not collude. You can say, I know that this must really suck for you. And, you know, I want to help you do the best you can while you're here. And this is part of the consequences of some of the stuff that's happened, right? This is how the system responds when there's somebody in danger, and this is why we're here. You don't have to pretend you don't have a job to do. You just have to be really clear about what your role is and why you're doing it, and be prepared to just be honest about it. I think really being able to say, this must be awful. I when I'm doing intakes, sometimes I think, what would I do if suddenly I got a protection order served on me, and now I have no access to my partner or my children? How would I respond? That would be so confusing to me. And I'm not a batterer. I hope I would never be in such a situation, but I just think that I can't imagine what that would feel like. It makes sense that there would be some confusion and some frustration, even if it's well-deserved and valid. Always leave room for a graceful exit. This is the other thing that Jim teaches us when he trains us, is that you want to always give them room to come back. When you have one of these blow-ups, somebody's just venting, something went wrong, we have to remember that we don't want to let them go so far that they can't come back, and if we can tell them that that's helpful, and we don't want to say anything, a threat or anything that can't come back if we're not going to follow that through and what that means. So again, no decisions on the spot, I would say. I think always staff it, always be really thoughtful about how you're going to respond after there's a big blow up. But I do think in the moment, giving somebody room to come back, even if they're on their way out, you've said this conversation's going nowhere, you need to go give us a call when you calm down, or give us a call this week and we'll talk about it again, so that they know that you haven't shut the door on them and that you're open to having a deeper discussion. And it may be that very well that you're going to discontinue services because that's what you need to do depending on the situation. But I think that doesn't mean you can't still have a conversation and discuss it. Again, avoid threats, especially threats you're not going to be able to follow through on, and threats don't work anyway. If somebody's in the middle of a heated blow-up and you're saying you're not going to get to see your kids anymore, they're not going to be thinking about that right in that moment. It might draw their attention for a minute, but only to come retaliate with another comment or another threat in return. And then remember the presence of others, and this came up in Beth's section as well. Just really noticing who's around, and it can be intimidating to other people, and also then it puts their ego on the line too when they realize other people may have seen this. And I know on that same situation where this guy was really going off in here, there was another man in the waiting room with him who was really uncomfortable. And so, we really made sure that we got that guy out of the room so he could be in the visit area and away from this guy who was really feeling like he was on the edge. And so just noticing that, who's there. And if there's children, if you're doing an intervention and somebody's blowing up, you need to be prepared. We all need to be prepared to get the kids out in a way that's not going to scare them, but as quickly as possible. I think that's one of the things we can talk about with kids. If we know that we have somebody who's potentially on the edge of escalating, I think that generally we kind of get a sense of who's more likely to blow up given the circumstances of what's been going on for the time that they've been using the program. And, I mean, that's true for us anyway. We kind of know, oh, this one's going to really be mad when we tell them this. But so knowing that if something's about to happen, how can you prepare the other people that might be there? And so, for instance, we had a visit recently where the kids had been refusing. One of them, the oldest, had been refusing and was really angry then because the father wouldn't see the younger sister because he was refusing with the older sister. So they wanted to go in and tell him they were really mad. They'd been to they were in therapy, and their therapist told them they could do that and we would keep them safe. But we felt like that we didn't know how he was going to respond to that. We thought he might immediately start bad-mouthing their mother, which has been the way that he's done things here in the past. So we worked with the kids for a few minutes before we took them in and just said, we just need you to know that if your dad starts to say certain things, we need to quickly hurry you out, and this is how we're going to do it. And really got them prepared. And I think that was helpful so that they knew that we had a plan in case it didn't go well for them. So I just think really thinking through everybody in this space and what it's going to look like. And then finally, the last but not the least, is keeping it all in perspective and taking good care of yourself. I think that it's really easy to just feel so responsible sometimes for what's going on, and feeling angry, and, you know, I mean, we go through the gamut. If there somebody's being really difficult, you feel annoyed. If there's a blow up and it didn't go well, you feel guilty. We feel responsible for the safety of the other person. And I think we need to step back and rely on each other, that we're doing the best we can. We want to think things through. We want to debrief and start over again wherever we need to. I think it's okay to apologize to clients and say, you know, I'm sorry that happened last week. Let's see where we can start over. I think really acknowledging where maybe we could have done better and acknowledging where they could participate in doing better as well. And watching out for that we don't let our clients come between us as staff, that we back each other up, so in doing that, then we have to be responsible to hold each other accountable as well. And that's what staff meetings are for, staff retreats. We need to really support each other in this, because it's such a strange beast, supervised visitation, and nobody else understands it except for people who are doing it. So, does anybody have any questions or comments?
We do have a question.
Okay.
We have a follow-up from the Nick Agnesen group. Your line is open.
Hi. On the staff, you know, the part about if we get, you know, kind of burnt out with the family that we're working with, my thought was maybe routinely switch out staff on as part of the program policy. Pros and cons on that idea.
Well, it depends on how you're doing it. I mean, I think that if something's going well and it's not a problem, we don't assign monitors to anybody. We kind of, whoever happens to be on does the family, and we always let the families know that that's the way we work. We're a team, and everybody kind of is on board about all the issues that come up. But that's, you know, we can do that because we have enough staff right now, and that's not true for everybody. So I think you just play out what are the pros and cons, what would be best. You work that out with your staff. What would happen if we did this, and how would we address it if that happened? Is it going well? Do we need to do this? You just got to think it through. Only you know how your particular program works.
Right. Well, my position was for continuity when you do get connected and you have a feel for, you know, the nonverbal cues and individuals, and if that would interrupt that. But basically what you said supports our program's philosophy.
And I think for us, what we have, there's a little bit of a fear around getting too connected too, because are you getting comfortable? And so sometimes we have this thing where we want everybody to know we're consistent in certain things. And so they need to know every staff is going to intervene on that particular thing.
Right.
But because we don't want them saying that person always lets me do this and this person doesn't, because that happens. They try that all the time. So
yeah.
I think, you know, however you set it up, you just want to be sure that there's a check-in process where everybody knows that they're still watching for the same types of things. You know, they're still watching the visit
fully,
even if they've been doing that family for 2 years.
Yeah.
I think the key would be not to think of it as something that routinely happens no matter what, that you do have a process where you talk about it and make sure it makes sense.
Yeah. And, well, reality, somebody can be sick. Somebody can have, you know, and not be available to sit in on that visit. And so there is a change. And I've seen where it can impact the visiting parent, because they have to relearn sometimes. Who, you know, as earlier, they're going to ask questions, why did, you know, so that was the reasoning behind the question, that it would be good for everybody to be on board with that particular, you know, with all the families we service, and that it changes once in a while because life is like that.
Right, and I think the important part is, too, just like you said, just make sure that people know what your plan is.
Right.
And what can happen, because, I mean, to not know that and then all of a sudden have it happen in the moment is hard for people. Change is hard no matter what it is, whether it's good or bad. And we also know that kids do a lot better when something is predictable and reliable.
Yep.
So
yeah.
If you can kind of make sure all of those pieces are taken care of, and then as a staff, your staff team decide what's best in this particular circumstance with what we know we have in front of us.
Right.
It's always better than making, you know, the across-the-board decision every 3 weeks we do something different.
Yeah. Well, this has been very helpful because this is brand new, some groundbreaking areas on what I'm learning, so I appreciate your information.
Well, thank you for your kindness. We appreciate you, too.
Okay. Well, I hope somebody else will ask questions, too.
You are the only brave soul today, apparently.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll be on the next one, too.
Or something.
Okay.
All right. Very good. Amy, do we have any other questions waiting for us?
At this time, there are no further questions.
All right. So we are just about, I think we have 3 minutes left, so we don't want to tackle any huge areas. But I just want to process a little bit of the last piece of what Tracy was saying and just reiterate that keeping this all in perspective and understanding how we cope with this, we as an individual staff person, we as a staff team, we as a center, move through this process for ourselves so that you can dissect it and learn and grow so that when something happens, you know, we've all been in this place where we thought, oh, gosh, I really didn't do well there. That was a big mistake. And, you know, you have to take those times and do the very best you can, know that you did the very best you can, but then also to process it and grow from it and learn what you could have done differently and not do that by yourself. I think the important part is that whether you have one other person that you work with or you have 20 other people that you work with, is to maintain a connection to say that we're all in this together. And we're learning and growing every day. Every minute of every day doesn't look like the last minute of yesterday. So that's the important piece, to just make sure that we have this way in which we can process it. We continue training, we continue educating ourselves, and we practice. So one of the things that I think is very helpful is if we as a staff team practice responses. You know, you never like to do role plays. People complain when we do role plays in trainings all the time. But they can be incredibly helpful to just process and practice. What would I do if somebody said this to me? What would I do if somebody said this to me? How can I explain this in a better way? So those are all tools that we can do to support each other.
We can really help each other notice when we're lecturing. I think sometimes, you know, here we have microphones all over, so whenever there's a difficult discussion happening, there's always somebody else kind of listening in to make sure it stays on track. And I'll go intervene if I feel like, okay, this is not going anywhere, or if it turns to kind of somebody's attacking the monitor. But I do think listening and then giving each other feedback around, well, that, you know, you handled this part really well, and here's what I thought about this, right? You know, I had a staff where I looked at her one time when she was really angry at the client. So later I told her, that look that you have on your face was really frightening to me, and if you were doing my visit, I'd be really uncomfortable. You know, what's going on? So being able to trust each other enough to give each other feedback, and then also to find humor in it. I just think there's not, it's crazy what we do, and some of our clients are just, what the things we find ourselves discussing can be just ridiculous sometimes. You're thinking, how the heck did I get myself into this conversation? What am I talking about? So I think being able to just really have your fellowship with your coworkers is so important. So
yep.
Important.
It is. And the last thing I think would be helpful, was helpful for us in our staff team, is to have a plan so that you have a response plan in place for when things happen, that you need backup help, how you can get backup help, how you call for assistance and not escalate the situation. So, you know, we talk a lot about code words that we give to children in visitation, and I think it's important for us as staff to understand each other and know that when we need help, we can do that in a way that doesn't escalate the situation. So thinking through what your plan is, how you move through this work together and exactly how we're going to do it. Because if you're not all on the same page with how you're responding, you're going to present like you're all over the place, and you won't be cohesive or consistent.
Yeah.
All right, so that leads us to the very final seconds of our training call. We try to be very respectful of your time. You've given us 75 minutes, and we try not to take a minute more than that. So thank you all for participating on today's call. I want to remind you that this was the first part of a three-part series. So next week, the same channel on February 18th is part two of this series, and it will be on listening and engaging in dialogue. And so I wanted to let you know I will not be with you. I will be at the new grantee meeting that's happening next week, but the call will happen. It will be an amazing call. Melissa Skaya is going to be our trainer for that call, so I hope you won't miss it. I also wanted to remind you that I'm going to send out an evaluation link to an online survey, and I really appreciate your feedback and the time it takes. I know it takes some additional time for you to do that. I try to make it and keep it very short, but I really do read all the evaluations, try to take them to heart, and try to put in place what your suggestions are. So I appreciate it, and it's always very nice to hear your thoughts and your comments on trainings that we put together. You know, sometimes feels like Tracy and I are talking into a black hole, except for our California participant. But you know, so we know there's one person out there listening to us. But it's always nice to hear from you. So we appreciate those comments and that feedback. Let's see. Oh, materials for next week's call will be emailed to you in the same way that you received them this week. So everyone who registered will get those materials just a couple days before the training. And then I will also have them posted on our website so you can download them from there. Tracy, do you have any parting words that you want to share before we hang up?
No, just have a happy weekend and remember to breathe.
That's right. All right, thanks everyone.
Bye-bye.